From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. The Ringling Brothers Circus is in Stockton. The show includes 10 performing elephants. Is it right to use exotic animals in this way? How should they be cared for? Find out today on Insight. Also, on September 1st, 1856, the young gold rush city of Sacramento opened its first high school. In the 1920s, Sacramento High School moved from downtown to Oak Park and, a few years ago, converted to a charter school. We'll hear from a city historian, plus a Sac High alum, a former teacher, and a current senior. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, exotic animals are a famous part of the traditional circus. How are they cared for? Do they even belong there? First, on September 1st, 1856, that's 150 years ago tomorrow, the young Gold Rush city of Sacramento opened its first high school. The founding class of 21 pupils studied in a one-room building on what was then M Street between 8th and 9th. Sacramento High School moved around, settling in Oak Park in 1924. In 2003, the city school district decided to convert Sacramento High into a charter school. It was a controversial decision, opposed by some of the school's teachers and parents, but it went through, and the old campus at 34th Street is now run by St. Hope Public Schools, an organization founded by Kevin Johnson, the former basketball star and Sacramento High alum. A little later, you'll meet another Sac High alum, a former teacher, and a current senior. First, for some historical perspective, Sacramento City and County historian James Henley. He couldn't join us this afternoon, so earlier today, I asked him what kind of city Sacramento was back in the mid-1850s, how big it was, who was living there.
Well, Sacramento as a city begins in 1848, early 1849, and so it's got about 6 years of growth. It's been through two disastrous fires that burned it to the ground. And what we know is the downtown part of the city, the central city with a rectangular grid from the waterfront up to, maybe 8th, 9th, or 10th Street, particularly along J and K, are pretty well developed with substantial buildings, brick, two and three, and in a few cases even four stories tall. The population of the city in the mid-late 1850s is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000-12,000 people.
What about education? How did people get educated in Sacramento so early in its history?
Well, there's a pretty big emphasis on education from the beginning, and it has to do with the looking at the kind of people who came here in the Gold Rush. Most of the people who came in the Gold Rush were relatively literate. They were reading. They came mostly from East Coast families out of New England. They knew how to read and write. They communicated, and so therefore they put a very high value on education. So the concept of education is very important very early on, and they attempt to build private schools and public schools almost immediately.
So the city was involved early on in providing schools?
Yes, and it's an interesting issue. It's actually the city that's doing it. You know, the school system was a function of city government until much later. Sacramento High School, for example, was established by the city, not by the private or an independent school district. The city was the school system.
Were children widely educated back in the 1850s, or was it restricted in any way?
I think education from its concept in California was open to virtually everyone. They thought that was almost a given right, and as a public education system, that was determined to be something that everybody should be eligible for. There was a private system generally run through the Catholic Church or by private educators. There were some private schools, and some families could afford to send their children to those institutions where maybe the intensity of education was a little bit heavier, but not necessarily. The public school systems were considered to be quite good here.
Doesn't Sacramento High include among its alumni one of Sacramento's best-known governors?
Oh, yes. That'd be Hiram Johnson, I believe.
Yes.
And certainly a lot of other people you could name went through the system. There's lots of people here. Sacramento is a very dynamic community in the 1850s. You're coming off of the high of the gold rush, and as gold starts to decline in the latter part of the 1850s, there's something else to take it up, and that happens in 1859. There is the discovery of silver in Nevada, the great Comstock rush. And the miners moved on to Nevada, and that was not a downturn for Sacramento because it became the staging area to supply the Comstock in Nevada. So, hence, Sacramento has in the 1855, the first railroad in California. The Sacramento Valley Railroad, which gets to Folsom, which is that much closer to the Comstock eventually.
The Sacramento High School, when it was created, I read, was on M Street in what we call downtown nowadays, and M Street now is Capitol Avenue. Mm-hmm. It eventually moved to what we now call Oak Park. What was that part of Sacramento in those days, the area that's now called Oak Park? Was it orchards, fields?
Well, Oak Park in the 1850s is pretty open country. There's virtually nothing out there except some early farming activities in the 1850s. But Oak Park establishes itself as a community by the late 1870s. It's an established community, and it has its own set of merchants, and it has its own sort of dynamics separate from the city of Sacramento. And that's because there was a community to the south, Elk Grove, which was a farming community, and it was a day's journey from Elk Grove to get to Sacramento, and therefore it was hard to make a return trip in the same day. But Oak Park was that much closer that it was a little easier to make a round trip from Elk Grove to Oak Park and back to Elk Grove, which gave it its own niche market to support. And it was a growing community. It becomes Sacramento's first annexation. Oak Park comes into the city early in the 20th century, along with what we know as East Sacramento.
And finally, Sacramento High School became a charter school a couple of years ago, and it was a controversial process. I know that there are some people, who former teachers there and some parents of students there, who don't consider the Sacramento Charter High School to be Sacramento High School, and therefore there isn't really a 150th anniversary in their mind. As a historian, where do you stand on that? Does it make sense to still recognize this as a 150-year-old institution, or is it a two-year-old institution?
Well, it really depends on where you're standing and looking at it. I guess from my point of view, it is a 150-year-old institution. You know, it's kind of looking at all these mergers of railroads, for example, is one railroad merges into the other, but, gee, they claim the heritage of both railroads. And I think Sacramento High School can certainly claim both heritages, its history as one of the earliest high schools in the region, and then it can also claim its heritage as a new institution established 2 years ago with some different directions. Which one is the one that survives over time will be an interesting issue for somebody else to ponder.
Yes. James Hanley, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I talked with Sacramento City and County historian James Hanley earlier today. We're going to talk more now about recent decades and years at Sacramento High. We've got several guests in our studio. Let's start with Frank Withrow, who's a former teacher at Sacramento High. Frank, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You taught at Sacramento High from 1972 to 1984. What was it like then? How was the school doing?
The school was probably the number one school in Sacramento at the time, especially in football. We didn't lose too many football games. We had great school spirit. Everybody wore purple and white on game days. I did a cheer at that time because I was in charge of the songs. It was in the Yale League. It's called Oh Yeah. It's in the sky. Oh yeah, it's Sac High. Oh yeah, it's on the pole. Oh yeah, it's Sac High Soul.
So that was you. You came up with that.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And how did that go down at the time?
Well, at that time, the major thing going on was football on Friday and Saturdays at Hughes Stadium. We didn't have any pro teams. High school was a big thing, and we would have 22,000 people at Hughes Stadium. And they would be rocking with that cheer. And we went about 11-0 and 10-1 and 9-2. And so the cheer and the school spirit was very high in those days.
What did you teach?
I taught business classes, typing and accounting and bookkeeping. I had a fashion and dance ensemble at the time. So we had a very young staff. I think about 75% of our staff was under 30. Or right around there, so we were very competitive with the kids and very willing to be at school probably 12-15 hours a day.
Was Kevin Johnson there at the time you were teaching?
Yes, he was. Kevin was there. Kevin graduated the same year I left. Excellent young man. He took my typing class. As a matter of fact, he said he liked my class because I played jazz. They always wondered, why do all the kids come to your class? Well, you have to have an alternative sometime. And mine was jazz music, Grover Washington and Bob James. And they got to listen to a little music and type at the same time.
Also with us is a Sacramento High School alum. It's Captain Daniel Hahn. He's a Sacramento Police Department captain. Captain Hahn, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
You were in the class of 1986. What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think back on your time there?
Well, I'm with Mr. Withrow. It was a great time. It was probably the best time in my life because in college I had to work full-time and go to school full-time. So I had a blast in college. I was part of the jazz band. We called them the Star Makers. We had a couple albums out. I was also part of the marching band and did a very short stint on the basketball team. So I'd say Sac High at that time was thriving and people had a blast and got their education at the same time.
Did you take Frank Withrow's typing class?
No, actually I did take typing, but it was after Frank left.
I see. And you said that you played basketball. Did you play with Kevin Johnson?
No, Kevin graduated when I was a freshman, so I never played with Kevin.
Mm. Tell us about the community at that time. How was Oak Park doing at the time? Let's start with Frank, when you started teaching at Sacramento High through 1986 when Captain Hahn graduated.
Oak Park was a thriving community. The fair had just moved to Cal Expo because the fairgrounds used to be on Broadway.
Just for people who don't know, that's the California State Fair.
California State Fair, yeah. It used to be down on Broadway right across from Stockton Boulevard.
Yes.
And about the time I came, they moved it to Cal Expo, where it is now, the current location. 35th Street had Joe's Style Shop and some other. They had a whole range of stores on 35th Street at that time. There was a fire and went on, and then some of those businesses moved downtown into other locations.
Was the community glad or sad to see the state fair go away?
I think a little of both. I think it had outgrown the location that it was in, and you know, you had to park in people's driveways and lawns and all types of things like that. So, I mean, it was a good move. People were sad to see it leave the area, but at the same time, they knew if it was for the best at that time.
Captain Hahn, what do you remember of the area around Sacramento High at that time when you were there?
Well, I grew up probably about five blocks from the school.
Really?
And so as most kids that grew up down the street from high school, I couldn't imagine going anywhere else, especially when my mom suggested that my grades weren't good enough, so I needed to go to Christian Brothers. Well, we had quite a bit of a fight. But the community around there was great. I mean, I don't think I was in my house more than a couple minutes after school. I was always at the park playing basketball, out with my friends in the middle of the street playing football. I can still remember football games in the middle of the street. So I'd say the community surrounding there was outstanding. And as you can see on some of the corners, such as the one St. Hope has redone, things are getting better. And palm trees down the middle, I can remember when they planted the palm trees down Broadway. I see things through work now and family still living in Oak Park that some things are getting much better in Oak Park, but it was great then.
If you go through Oak Park nowadays, there are quite a few lots where there's nothing there. I guess in many cases they were burned down. Frank, when did that start?
It started just before I got here. And everything wasn't burned down. Some of those lots have been vacant for years.
Really?
And years, yes. One of the lots right at the corner, for instance, across from Bank of America, what is now Martin Luther King, which was Sacramento Boulevard at the time. Now it's Martin Luther King. It had little thriving businesses on the other side of the street, but they tore those down. They had garages. They had a record shop down there, Cole's Variety. A lot of things have changed, but a lot of things have gotten better.
Also with us is Tarisha Baker, who's a senior at Sacramento High. Tarisha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're in the class of 2007, and this is your fourth year at the school.
Yes.
Yeah? So you were there before it became a charter.
Well, my first year I was there when it had just opened as a charter. So,
I see.
Yeah.
And were you aware of all that was going on at that time, the big debate about whether or not it should become a charter? Was that something that affected you?
No.
Yeah.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, I took part in one of the debates. I sat and watched, but I didn't know really about much that was going on, so it really didn't affect me much.
What are you involved in at school?
The 34th Street Dance Company.
Really?
Yes.
What kind of dancing do you do?
Hip-hop, jazz, modern, ballet.
Okay. What else is going on?
Sports right now, our football. We're not doing so good in that. So our basketball team is good, though, for the past couple years. Yes, we've been doing good in basketball, made it to ARCO a few times. Our ballet isn't there anymore. They took that out. So, like, as far as activities go, there's not, you know, much, but, you know, we have our small schools that we're in, you know, the School of the Arts, School of Business and Communications, School of Math, Engineering, Health Sciences, and School of Public Services, which basically you're put in the school that prepares you for what you want to do after you graduate high school. Like for me, I'm in the School of Arts, so I want to dance. So it's preparing me for the future in dance.
Frank, I know that some former teachers at Sacramento High are opposed to the conversion to a charter. What do you think about it?
I'm fine with the charter. I've always been a little different than everybody else anyway. So my attitude is change is good. I don't know when you went to school, but they're still doing a lot of the same things they did when I went to school, and they're outdated. And it's time for some changes in education, time for some shakeups. And if this works, then let it be.
There were some teachers at the time, and I guess they still would say that it was in part, they call it union busting. If you had been a teacher at Sacramento High at that time of the conversion, would you have been inclined to stay?
I had a lot of issues with the union, too. I didn't think everything they did was right, and I still don't. I was forced to be a part of the union. I didn't choose to be. When I first came, there were two different unions. They made a vote. They made it one union. And whether you wanted to be or not, you had to pay union dues. So I'm the kind of person who would like to represent it myself. I think I did enough things after school, before school, during school that, I may have been able to get merit pay on my own.
Is this something you discuss with former colleagues?
All the time. A lot of them didn't like me. A lot of them liked me, but they didn't like my opinions about things. When they struck, I didn't strike because I didn't start teaching to strike. I crossed the lines and I went in and I taught school. So, you know, it depends on what you feel. And that was what I felt. I came up through, I'm one of the first kids in integrated schools in the country in 1954. So my attitude is I taught and do teach because I didn't want kids to feel like I felt in the classroom. And money, I didn't teach for money. If I taught for money, I'd have found another job.
And Captain Han, you're an alum, graduated in 86. What do you think? Did you have an opinion on the conversion at the time?
Well, my opinion is basically that I know Kevin Johnson and St. Hope care about the community and about the school. And I think that's the main thing of whoever's running a school is, do they really truly care? And from that stance, I think it's a great thing. We also have a criminal justice academy with an officer that's at the school starting this year that has 75 students in it already. So I think whatever it takes to get kids to education, every kid's different. Like Tarisha said, she's into dance. Some kids are into music. Some kids are into football. And I think we need to establish a school system that serves all those kids and their diverse needs. And if that's what it takes to have academies, different academies on one school, to have smaller schools within a school, then that's what we need to do.
Would you have been okay if it hadn't converted?
I'm Sac High Dragon regardless. So for that question earlier on whether it's 150 years, it's 150 years and it's going to continue counting. There's no change. Sac High is Sac High.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate you joining us today. That's Tarisha Baker, senior at Sacramento High, Captain Daniel Han of the Sacramento Police Department and a Sac High alum, and Frank Withrow, former teacher at Sacramento High from 1972 to 1984. Thank you all very much.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the Ringling Brothers Circus is in Stockton this weekend. The show includes 10 performing elephants. Is it right to use exotic animals in this way? If it is, how should they be cared for? We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Almost from day one, Insight has attracted the smartest interns you can imagine. Help us maintain that tradition by applying to join our team. info@capradio.org/insight. The circus is in town, if you live in Stockton. The Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus opens tonight at the Stockton Arena and runs through Sunday. It comes to Sacramento late September. Along with the clowns, acrobats, strongman, and motorbike riders are dozens of animals and birds, including 10 Asian elephants. People are divided over performing animals. Some find them charming to watch, while others are troubled. Today, we'll talk about the use of wild or exotic animals as performers. Is it appropriate? If it is, how are they best cared for? Are any changes needed? Let's start with the man who literally wrote the book about the care of exotic animals. He's Murray Fowler, an internationally known veterinarian with special expertise in non-domestic animals. He's a former professor at UC Davis and has worked for many organizations that keep exotic animals, including Sacramento Zoo and Ringling Brothers. Murray Fowler's books include Zoo and Wild Animal Medicine, the first English language book on the subject. He's also an expert on the restraint and handling of animals. Murray Fowler, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Do lions and elephants belong in a circus?
Yes, they do. I believe that they serve a useful purpose, and they're contributing to the education of people and the enjoyment of people.
Have you ever been to a circus where you saw exotic animals that you felt were not being cared for appropriately or were being made to do things that seemed inappropriate?
Well, I've seen animals do a lot of things, and I know that they're capable of it, but there are places that I have been in the world where circus animals were not taken care of properly. But that's not the case in most circuses here in the United States.
Has that always been the case in your experience in the United States?
I would have to say that it has improved over the years with the increased knowledge.
And what remains to be done? Your response suggests perhaps that there are other improvements could still be made.
There is always room for improvement, and many of the organizations, the circuses, are trying to deal with that, to bring their transportation up to the optimum, and the like, so that there's always room for improvement.
Also with us is Nicole Paquette, who's Director of Legal and Government Affairs at the Animal Protection Institute, which is a national organization based in Sacramento. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, same first question to you. Do exotic animals like elephants and tigers belong in a circus?
Absolutely not. Wild and exotic animals should not be used in any type of entertainment, specifically in the circus. The elephants in particular are kept confined up to 21 hours a day on chains. They're also forced to perform demeaning and unnatural tricks under the threat of intimidation and force by the use of a bullhook or an ankus.
But those are specific circumstances. If those specific circumstances didn't exist, and I'm not saying whether they do or not, but if they did, if they were not to exist, would that make it okay, therefore, to have lions and tigers and so on in a circus?
The common industry training methods utilize at this stage is to use force and intimidation. If there are able to use methods like with essentially with individual types of training, then it would still be shocking to me to see whether or not they actually could perform without the use of intimidation devices.
Tell us how you know that circuses in the United States are using those techniques today.
Well, there has been footage up as recently as in March of this year showing Ringling Brothers handlers hitting and striking elephants with the use of the bullhook. There has been undercover footage of circuses showing that there has been the use of electric prods as well as bullhooks and chains utilized on these elephants to force them to perform.
What's a bullhook?
A bullhook is also called an ankus, but it's a training device. It's about 3 feet long. It's a wood handle with a sharp metal hook at the end. Both ends are utilized to intimidate and to break the animal and force him to perform. Mm.
Murray Fowler, do you agree? Are these techniques
I do not used? Agree. I think that the guide, as it's more properly called, rather than a bull hook, is not a sharp object. It is a blunt object, and it's used to direct an animal or to give it a cue. And I do not believe that in for instance, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, that they are using these devices to intimidate. They're using them as training devices, and the animal is not abused in this situation.
Could you describe the guide, the instrument that Nicole is referring to as a bull hook? Could you describe it, please?
Yes, it's either a wooden or aluminum-handled object that's about, 2.5 to 3 feet long, depending on when it's being used, and it has usually a metal object on the end of it that has a curve on it that allows a person to kind of touch the animal behind the leg, and it also has a straight object on it to punch the animal, and I use that term as just a means of touching the animal to give it a cue to perform some behavior.
Is there a sharp edge anywhere in this object?
Well, in the past, they have been sharp, but they're not supposed to be. And the elephant interest group that is kind of looking over this area feels that they should not be sharp.
Nicole, if this hook is not sharp, Is it perhaps not just some kind of mechanism for making an elephant to go somewhere, but without hurting it?
Well, the manner in which these methods are used against the elephants is to force them to perform. All they need to do, the handler, is to show them the bull hook, and essentially they are afraid not to perform. I've seen no circus or no other type of entertainment industry that uses elephants use anything other than the elephant, the bull hook. And essentially, if we were to have used a bull hook on a dog or a cat, we would be charged with animal cruelty under the state's animal cruelty laws. However, it is acceptable to use it on an elephant in every single state, which is why we brought AB 3027 this past legislative session, which would have prohibited the use of the bull hook.
Murray, do you agree with that, that if this instrument were used on a dog or a cat, that it would be illegal?
Well, that specific instrument, but there are other devices that are used the choke chain has been used as a training device. And certainly any of these methods that are used in training can be misused. But that doesn't mean that they're always misused. They are bona fide training procedures that can do the job, and they don't have to intimidate the animals to behave. I have watched elephants go through their maneuvers out in the yard, and they're not on chains 100% of the time, and they would thus go through their behaviors. And I've seen elephants in the wild stand up and reach for feed. So when you say they are forced to do intimidating or unnatural behaviors, I don't agree with that.
Nicole, I just want to wrap up the discussion of the guide or a bull hook, depending on what you want to call it. Do you agree with Murray's description of it, that it does not have sharp edges?
I disagree. I mean, we've seen bull hooks. They do have a sharp edge. The industry would obviously tell you that the hook is not sharp. However, after seeing certain incidences where an elephant has been hit, you instantly see blood coming out of the elephant's skin. An elephant has various pressure points all over their body, and those are the various points where a animal trainer hits the animal with those hooks. And essentially, to go back to Mr. Fowler's point about not seeing any having the elephant not actually perform with the use of this hook, essentially the animal is broken at a very early age and is trained with that bull hook. And essentially you can see why, even when the circus is here, you will watch that every single handler has a bull hook in their hand, and all they have to do is lift the bull hook and show the elephant, and the elephant is afraid. The elephant is afraid that they are going to be hit with that instrument, so they do the desired command.
Murray, as I noted in the introduction, your expertise includes the restraint and handling of animals. Would you consider the guide or the bull hook, as Nicole refers to it, as an appropriate way to handle and restrain an elephant if it were not in the context of a circus? Let's say it were being, for some reason, at UC Davis getting treatment. Would it be an appropriate device there?
Well, I've dealt with many elephants at UC Davis for treatment and or examination. And these animals are not frightened of these objects, and I don't agree that these animals are beaten into submission as a means of intimidating them so that all you have to do is talk, I think, or lift that hook. I've watched elephants certainly in many cases where they just respond in a normal manner to this kind of touching. And it's not hitting, it's touching.
Of course, touching an elephant is, I guess you need to touch an elephant more than you touch a human, because the elephant is so big, it's so powerful, and it's got this thick skin. Do you need to touch elephants in a way that might look like it's more forceful than it needs to be?
In actual fact, the skin, even though it's thick, is mostly leather. And they have nerves very close to the surface, just as close as a horse or a cow would have. And so you don't have to, if you touch them, of course, any touching now considered by people who are against elephants in circuses, they're going to say it's being hit.
Nicole, earlier you referred to videos that were taken of the way elephants were being handled in circuses. How up-to-date are those videos, and who took the videos?
They are up-to-date, as I stated, as March of this year. In addition, various people across the country who have witnessed performances have taken these videos. In addition, my organization is part of a lawsuit against Ringling Brothers for violating the Endangered Species Act, and it is based, again, on their common training methods of the use of the bull hook, because we feel and assert that the use of the bull hook is actually a taking of an endangered species.
Are these videos taken by the circus itself for some training purpose, or are these videos taken by people who've, I guess, snuck in?
These videos have been taken by people who have witnessed the elephants and the elephant trainers walking in public access ways.
Murray, have you seen any of these videos? And if so, have you seen anything that troubled you?
I have not seen these particular videos, but I have seen videos that have been supposedly taken of animals in training or on horse trail rides and this sort of thing. And I can't say that any of them are accurate that I have witnessed.
We've been talking up until now about the way the elephants are handled, I guess, while they're being trained and when they're being moved around. I'd like to touch on what they do when they're performing in the circus. And I'd like to read just a sentence from the Ringling Brothers press release about the show that's touring right now and is in Stockton this weekend. It says, "At the Circus of Dreams, Asian elephants groove to a hip-hop beat." What do you think of that show, particular show, Nicole? I don't know whether you've seen it or not, but just based on the sound of it.
Oh, I think it's a bit of an embarrassment for the elephants. The elephants in the wild walk miles and miles. They do not stand up on their head in the wild. They do not roll on balls, and they certainly do not sit up and down in rapid succession as they do in the Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus. In addition, this particular show has a screen of elephants doing they're actually not the real elephants, but they're just dancing on a big screen. Again, it shows to our children a wrong image of what these elephants do in the wild. It gives them the wrong appreciation of elephants, and circuses do nothing to help conservation efforts in the wild. None of these animals are ever released. They are simply bred and bred and bred for future performers, as well as to bring money into the pockets of the circus industry.
You said it's an embarrassment for the elephants, but do elephants get embarrassed, or are you talking more about the human reaction to seeing the elephants grooving?
Well, obviously, I'm talking about the image that us as humans see in those elephants. If you were to watch them in the wild, they are extremely majestic and beautiful creatures, and you do not see them, like, as I said, sitting on balls. You do not see them standing on their head. You certainly do not see them walking in a line holding the other elephant's trunk or tail.
But do you know that it's troubling to the elephants to be doing that? I mean, I realize that for at least some people, and maybe many people, they don't like to watch elephants doing this. But do you know that it's troubling to the elephants?
Well, I don't think anyone truly knows whether or not it's troubling to the elephants, but one could only assume that given the fact that these elephants are wild animals, they should not be forced to be performing in industries where humans are essentially paying a fee to a corporation, and all that money goes back to the corporation. It has nothing to do with the elephants' conservation efforts in the wild.
Okay, Murray, what do you think about the kinds of things that the elephants are made to do in the circus, in this case, doing hip-hop dancing? Do you have any reservations about that kind of thing or not?
Well, in contrast, I have seen this show. In fact, excuse me, I was in Stockton on Monday when we moved these animals from the train to the arena in Stockton. And I have seen that show in a number of places because I've been at the... And those animals are doing things, and if you look at them, they're excited. They're having a good time. They're having an opportunity to move and to do the things that they normally do. And in contrast, I have seen elephants in the wild stand on their head. I have seen them sit and slide down a slope into a water. I have seen them stand on their hind legs. So that to say that these animals are not doing things that they would normally do in the wild is an error. And I just feel that these animals are not fearful. They're not being mistreated.
When you've consulted for circuses and other organizations, have there, though, been things that they've wanted the animals to do or were making the animals do when they were performing that you thought was just not appropriate and suggested they stop doing it?
I can't say that I have. I've seen a lot of different kinds of circuses, both in the United States and in other countries. And sometimes it's not the performance that's the problem. It's the way they're cared for outside. And that has been more a problem in foreign countries than it has been in the United States.
I should note that Murray Fowler is not speaking for Ringling Brothers, although you have worked for them in the past.
Oh, yes.
Do you currently work for them?
Yes.
You do. We did invite Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey to take part in our program today, but they told us that their representative in this issue is traveling this afternoon on an airplane and so could not participate in our program, but they did send us a statement. We asked them to do that, and here's an excerpt. This is from Ringling Brothers. Our animal care program is one of the most comprehensive of its kind in the world and incorporates experience and expertise gained from 136 years of traveling and working closely with Asian elephants and other exotic animals. The statement continues, the animals themselves are proof of the excellent care they receive. Anyone who sees a Ringling Brothers circus can see the animals are thriving, they're active, have good muscle tone, and are interested and comfortable in their surroundings, all indicators of good health. Ringling Brothers has an excellent record of meeting and exceeding all federal, state, and local standards for animal welfare because the physical and behavioral needs of our animals are a top priority. We're proud of our human and animal relationships, one that's built on mutual respect, trust, and affection. That's the end of this excerpt from the Ringling Brothers statement. If you'd like to read the whole of it, it's posted at capradio.org/insight. Nicole, your reaction to that statement?
Well, that's their common statement that they issue in various cities across the country. A few of the points that they do make is that they do state that they have a wonderful record of animal care, yet at their breeding facility, four babies have died there. One was ill, yet was forced to perform at only 3 years old and had died subsequently thereafter. In addition, they stated on their statement that they meet or exceed all federal and state regulations. Well, if you were to look at the federal law that they say they meet and exceed, it is the Animal Welfare Act, which is a very minimal Animal Welfare Act, which basically sets forth minimum standards of care. They've actually had over 100 deficiencies in that and are currently being investigated for four different incidences by the USDA. In addition, the state of California has very minimal laws to this point because they haven't been enforced for the last 30 years, which I currently sit on an advisory committee, and we are looking to enforce them. So for them to say that they meet or exceed, there's really not much to meet or to exceed, which is exactly why we brought a bill this year.
Murray?
Well, the comment was made that they were not involved in conservation. She mentioned the fact that there is a conservation center in Florida, and they have, to date, have produced more than 21 baby elephants. The fact that some of them die is true in any animal situation. And to say that it was a result of their traveling and being forced to do things is not a correct assumption in this situation. The USDA regulations that she says are broken or are responsible for having infractions are simply minor things that don't really impinge on the well-being and the care the elephants are given.
That's Murray Fowler, the veterinarian, an expert in the care of exotic animals. Also in our studio, Nicole Paquette, Director of Legal and Government Affairs at the Animal Protection Institute in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the owner of a company that rents trained exotic animals, the film, TV, and live production companies. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We're talking about exotic animals performing in circuses and in film and TV. There's a Northern California company that rents trained exotic animals to film, TV, and live production companies. The owner is Charlie Samet. His company, Wild Things Animal Rentals, Inc., is based in Salinas. Charlie, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Tell us how you got into this line of work.
Oh, working with other people already doing it. a love of animals and the possibility and the ability to combine a love of animals and make a living doing it. So,
well, it's one thing to have a dog or a domestic cat. It's another thing to have a wild animal. How did you get into that part of it?
Well, because they're not pets, and they shouldn't be had as pets. So the only correct way to do it is on a professional level in a professional animal industry, whether it be circus or entertainment, education. We do as much educational work as we do film and television, if not more. So the only right way to do it is within one of the scope of one of those industries. They just don't make pets.
Do you turn down any clients because you're not convinced that they will treat the animals appropriately?
Absolutely. I mean, I guess what we're saying is, do we turn down work that we feel would not be in the best interest of our animals?
Yes.
Sure. Sure. If we read a script and we feel it can't safely be done, we just simply turn it away. You know, there's shows on TV today that we question how they're being done, why they're being done. Fear Factor is a good example. I have no idea how they're filming some of that stuff and getting away with it, but we've turned it down.
What about animals and circuses? I don't know if you go to the circus at all, but when you see animals and circuses, do you think that all of the animals you see there should be there, are appropriately there, and are doing things that are okay?
Well, I think it depends on the individual circus, and I think it depends on the animals and what they're being asked to do. Now, I did coincidentally, and this is sheer coincidence, I did just recently visit Ringling's new show while it was here in San Jose, California, and I was extremely impressed. I told my friends there, I think that the circus is evolving now, and it's evolving in a direction that's in the best interest of the animals, And I couldn't disagree more with the statement that conservation is not being accomplished there in the fashion that it's being presented now.
Yeah, we just have a couple of minutes. Charlie, are there any changes that you would like to see, either in the law in California or just in the way that companies like Ringling and zoos handle and treat and acquire animals?
No, I think we're moving in the right direction as it is. I really do, and I hope it doesn't go so far that we lose our ability to continue educating people in the fashion that Ringling is doing it.
Okay, Charlie Samet, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Charlie Samet of Wild Things Animal Rentals, Inc. And we'll wrap things up with our two studio guests, Murray Fowler and Nicole Paquette. Murray, your final thoughts on this?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to come. I think that there is a need for circuses. There is a desire on the part of the public to the houses are filled every time, and they're not coming there to just see animals abused. They're coming for entertainment, and in the process, they also learn some things.
But would it be better for them to see the animals behaving more in a way that's more typical of their normal lifestyle?
I don't think that is possible under the circumstances. You can say it. They could just use animal videos that were taken in Asia or Africa and this sort of thing. But that is not the same as to see an animal up close.
Okay. And Nicole Paquette?
Well, just the fact that that it's not the same to see an animal in the wild on a video screen doesn't make it right to use those animals and force them to perform tricks. Various circuses across the country have switched to eliminate their animals in circuses and are making a large profit on that. The use of animals in circuses is a thing of the past, and I think that we as a civilized society and as an advanced society, that's at a point shortly in the future, is going to recognize that and start realizing that we shouldn't be participating in those types of activities.
And listeners, a reminder, Ringling Brothers was unable to participate in our show today, but you can read their statement that they sent us at capradio.org/insight. Thank you very much to our two studio guests, Nicole Paquette, who you just heard, of the Animal Protection Institute in Sacramento, and Murray Fowler, the well-known veterinarian, expert on the care of exotic animals. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, the Pentagon says many Guantanamo detainees may be eligible for release. There's a review process and hundreds have already left the camp, but lawyers for the inmates say the process is arbitrary and political. That story in the day's news next on The World. Today's associate producers were Anna Reeder, Nicole Breen, and Rob Whitlock. Rob, welcome to Insight. Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. And thank you for joining us.